Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I'll bet you know where I'm going this evening. I don't mean physically. Hi, this is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. A little internet radio experiment that's been ongoing for the better part of a decade now. We like to call what we do conversation radio, because it's more than just the usual megadiddos from Busted Knuckle Rush. I want to have your babies. My friend, that's enough about you. Let's talk about me. No, it's ever so much more than that. It really is conversation radio. It's listener-supported, you know. That means that for those years that we've been on the air, it's been on the air because people like you have made sure that it has stayed on the air. We try to raise about $150 per night. We are behind, as we are most months. So anything over and above $150 is wonderful this evening. Anything is wonderful. Who am I trying to kid? The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the snail mail address. Should you wish to send your contribution that way, please remember when you do so, make the check or the money order payable to The Horn, Head On Communications, Head On Radio Network. Anything but Bob, well, like that, but not Bob Kincaid, because Bob doesn't get the money. Lord knows what there is of it goes to folks with a greater claim on it than, well, you get the idea. The Horn is available on a wide variety of platforms out there on the intertubes, not just the listen live button at headonradionetwork.com, but also places like streama.com, dar.fm, my personal favorite smartphone app, so you can take The Horn with you when you go, is TuneIn Radio. There is also Stitcher Radio, as well as a little tuner internet radio app. But all of those things make The Horn portable. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Okay, got that out of the way. Email address for reaching the program is bobkincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. The phone number is 304-658-3333. One of these days we'll get the toll-free number out of Hawk. I sure would like that, and I know you will. You would as well. That is an ongoing struggle with the fine folks at CityNet. At any rate, I said I bet you know where I'm going. I probably should have put that better. I bet you know what caught my ear in the inaugural address. There was a lot of speechifying. Could have been shorter. Could have been longer. Ron in Raleigh will get us started with his email observations. He says, I listened to the president's speech and found myself becoming sadder as it went on. Was I listening to a political speech or a sermon? How many times did he mention God or the Creator? I imagine that when he mentioned his concern for the children of Appalachia, it made you a little sad as well. Yeah, that's where my... When he spoke of a little girl living in poverty attaining her dreams, when he knows as well as you or I that upward mobility in the U.S. is a shrinking dream. As his administration continues to blow brown people and American citizens into red mist whenever he feels the need, without the semblance of due process, I look back at the real history of America and realize that despite high-flown rhetoric, when given the choice between two paths, we will invariably take the wrong one. We back murderous dictators. We fund death squads. We depose democratically elected governments, all in the name of American corporate interests. I believe in the macro, things look to be getting better. However, in the micro, structural area, the country continues down its path as a quasi-security state with an overlay of corporate control. The blowback to our adventures in the Middle East and Near East won't be seen for about 25 years. I'll be long dead, but your kids and my nieces and nephews will have to deal with the hatred we are causing right now. The fact that we can't look at our history honestly will lead to the downfall of the American empire. And I say the sooner the better. Perhaps then we can start to heal some of the damage we've caused. There's a lot inside that note. Yeah, the line, and this is the line, grabbed me because it's something we spend a significant portion of our time on. In order to provide the full context, Barack Obama today, in his second inaugural address, I don't know how far to back up on this. Let's go back a couple of paragraphs. Let's do a little work. A little textual criticism, if you will. We the people declare today that the most evident truth of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall. More on Selma in a moment. Just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday today. Can you imagine celebrating that at the same time we were inaugurating Willard Romney, whose church only in the late 1970s declared people of color to be fully human? Can you imagine? Sometimes the goddess of irony does take a break. And this was one of those days. But I understand what Ron's getting at, and we're not done. This inaugural address had several little pokes in it, several little jabs, and yeah, I smiled at a few of them. One of them was in what I just read. Just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. Why not just say, to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. say? Why not say that? Instead of saying, to hear a king. I have my theory, and it is this. Have you heard the right wing screeching, hopping up and down, scratching themselves and flinging poo as is their wont? Have you heard them referring to King Obama? And how he wants to take our guns? Because it's out there. And for those of us with an understanding and an appreciation of history, deep history, it is most disconcerting. some of you like it and some of you don't when I go running off into ancient history. This one is unavoidable, however. After he had been declared dictator for life, and dictator did not necessarily have the negative connotations that it has today. It comes from a word that means speaker. It would be as if someone had declared John Boehner speaker for life. And I swear I thought when I saw them pouring the wine at the table for the luncheon after the post-inaugural luncheon, I could have sworn I saw him take a swipe trying to just grab the wine bottle and hang on to it. Well, never mind. Speaker, dictator. It's the same word. But after he had been declared dictator for life, certain elements in what was fast becoming the fading, almost concluded experiment in republican government that was ancient Rome, which was primarily an oligarchy in which the rich were constantly scrabbling to keep those damned peons from getting any sort of representative power in government. But shortly after he was declared dictator for life, a cadre of the nastiest, most conservative, most wealthy individuals in the Roman Republic began to mumble and mutter that Gaius Julius Caesar, had ambitions of becoming king. Now, the Roman Republic had been born out of a rejection of kingship. The last king having been deposed, the Senate was formed. Senate being taken from the Latin root word meaning old. And the Roman Republic grew from there, slowly overtaking the entire Italian peninsula, and then eventually expanding into Asia Minor and Spain, North Africa. And so it was that by the time 45 BCE, before the Common Era, had rolled around, the wealthy, the conservatives, screaming about liberty and patriotism and love of country, and knowing that they could always push the buttons of the ignorant by hollering about a return to kingship, began to bruit it about, et tu, Brutus, that Caesar wished to be king. He did not. There is no historical evidence that he did. The idea of kingship was as odious to Gaius Julius Caesar as it was, and perhaps more so, to the people who called themselves the optimates, the best. People like Cato the Younger, people like Cicero, and a whole host of others, Marcus Junius Brutus. You know the players, right? And they hollered and hollered and hollered about how Caesar had taken their liberties from them. Until a cadre of those optimates, you know, Cassius has a lean and hungry look, took matters into their own hands and chopped Julius Caesar into ceviche in the temple that served as the senatorial curia at the back of Pompey's theater. And it all rode on the wave of those cries of kingship. After the dastardly murder had been accomplished, Brutus and Cassius and the like went out donning caps of liberty to declare that freedom and the republic had been restored. And I suspect, as much as I hate to admit it, I suspect it more likely, since they've got things like the Cato Institute, I suspect, because Cato is revered as a lover of freedom and democracy, when in fact he was nothing more than a spoiled, self-involved little proto-dictator himself, I suspect that the right wing knows more of this history than do we. And they know what effect hollering that someone is setting himself up as a king has upon certain elements of our culture. And when I first heard king being bruited about, I shivered, because I knew that in so doing, the right wing had formally announced that they have murder in their hearts. It was an interesting weekend. I had a fascinating conversation with a guy who was arguably right wing and a gun toter, had his pistol on his hip when I talked to him. And we talked about this idea of that goes around the right wing of, well, that Obama's going to come for our guns, and we're going to keep our guns in case the government tries to take away our liberties and freedoms and get the jackbooted boots on our throats, and then we'll rise up. All right? And he said to me, not I to him, he said, these people need to understand, these so-called firearms advocates need to understand that when they talk about rising up, they're talking about eventually firing on American soldiers and American citizens. And that, in fact, they are talking treason. I was kind of surprised. That was interesting to come from someone who was of the right-wing persuasion. But at least he recognized the reality of it. So if, in fact, you were wondering why Barack Obama said to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth, I suspect that's the reason for it. To draw a very bright distinction between Dr. King, whose holiday this is, and the phony baloney treason-laden cries of King Obama that are being noised about among certain largely treasonous right-wing circles. But let us continue. President Obama continued, in his address, "It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete." And isn't that interesting that usually when we think of pioneers, we think of some white family rumbling across the unbroken West in a Conestoga wagon looking for land to steal from the natives. But suddenly, the word pioneer takes on a new meaning. Pioneers being defined as people who struggled for basic human rights, whether it be at Seneca Falls or Selma or Stonewall. "Our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts," Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. This is pretty high-blown stuff. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. And then this. Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. Now, by referencing children in the hills of Appalachia with children from the streets of Detroit and children from the shady lanes of Newtown, Connecticut on either side of them, one could easily have heard that and say, well, you know, that's another remark about gun violence. Not to me, it wasn't. While I was in Washington, D.C. last week, I got to spend a little time with Maria Gonneau, and she was telling me about yet another of the children down near where she lives in Boone County, West Virginia. A young woman, 19 years old, roughly the same age as our own Margie here. And the young woman is in the hospital now. She has grown up in the shadow of a mountaintop removal operation. All her life, she has heard the rumblings of the blast, seen the filth in the water, and the rolling clouds of dust that billow down off those nightmare sites. And as I said, she is now in the hospital. She is terminal. She has breast cancer. She has lung cancer. She has stomach cancer, and she has bone cancer. It was reported to me that the family has been told, well, some people just have bad DNA. Although in that community, apparently there's an awful lot of bad DNA. A lot of people have cancer. Those are the children. For 19 years old is not far from childhood at all, as many of us recognize who have gotten beyond that age. That is the kind of child that I was reminded of when Barack Obama said, all our children from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. There is no child in any mountaintop removal community of Appalachia that is either cared for or cherished or always safe from harm as long as the 5.5 million pounds of high explosives attendant upon mountaintop removal continue to be detonated day after day after day after day after day. Among the 4,000 West Virginians, we don't even have the numbers yet for what happens in Southwest Virginia or Eastern Kentucky or East Tennessee. But among the 4,000 excess death West Virginians who die every year simply because they live in a mountaintop removal community, there are children.
and they deal with things like bone cancer and lung cancer and brain cancer and breast cancer. And their mamas deal with all of the same, and their daddies and their grandpas and their grandmas. And so the measure between empty rhetoric and real words that lead to actions beyond aspiration is what we do when we are confronted with these realities. I'm not from Detroit. I can't tell you about the horrors and trauma and terrors and trials and tribulations faced by a child trying to grow up poor in that city. There are those among us in the Horn family who do know those stories, and this program exists for the telling of those stories. And I surely can't talk about the horror that has descended upon Newtown, Connecticut, and yet resides there and will long reside there, if ever it may even be said to be expected to dissipate. But I know, and we here do know, what it is to see children sick, to see them wheeled into surgery. That we know. And, frankly, we know that there is an answer. Because some of us have crafted that answer. And many of you have aided in pushing for the successful passage of that answer. And that answer is the AID Act, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And we are about to ramp up our efforts to levels higher than anything we have yet accomplished. We may not be live tomorrow night. It depends entirely on how quickly we can get to Washington, D.C., because we're going back for more work. More days of taking hat in hand, knocking on doors, and begging members of Congress. Begging, I tell you. All semblance of human dignity gone. Begging. Begging. For the lives of those Appalachian children who are cared for, who are cherished, and who are never safe from harm. We will beg, we will plead for the lives of our babies. Some of those pleas will fall on deaf ears. Sometimes they will not. And we may surely separate the wheat from the chaff in forming the list of those who say yes, yes to the AIC Act, as compared with those who say things like, yeah, but what about the jobs? Or who blithely take money from the coal industry and look the other way as our children perish. This should be easy. This should be, as the saying goes, a no-brainer. I sure do hope that it might be. But there is no guarantee. So I understand the mixed emotions with which Ron watched the inaugural. I understand it well. Looking here at a note dated January 21st, 2013, written by the little brother of a member of the Horn family to his member of Congress in Maryland, Billy's little brother is Scott. Agnes, sniffling, just emailed this along to me. It is written in the clear printed hand of a child. It says 1-21-13. Dear Mr. Van Hollen, thank you for my birthday calendar. Please support the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act so boys and girls can be healthy in West Virginia. Love, Scott. Excuse me. Please indeed. So, yeah, that's what was on my mind. Especially when Barack Obama followed up by talking about letting children in the hills of Appalachia know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. When he said that that is the kind of thing that defines our journey. When he followed in the next paragraph by saying, that is our generation's task, to make these words, these rights, these values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness real for every American. And said that being true to our founding documents does not require us to agree on every contour of life. It does not mean we will all define liberty in exactly the same way or follow the same precise path to happiness. Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. And so it does. And so we get back in the vehicle tomorrow, and we go back to Washington, D.C. And we go back to work for the sake of, and in the name of, and in the hope for those children in the hills of Appalachia. And you, in turn, because I know what you have done in the past, you will act in your time as we do in ours. And you will try to see to it that this bill gets passed, the AIC Act. there was much more in the address. Much more that I'm sure we will talk about. The words spoken about the LGBT community were historic because they were said at all. The words about climate change were historic because they were said at all. But one is also reminded, if one comes from, even like me as a recovering Southern Baptist, if one comes from having been raised in that tradition, of which one can never be fully cured, one is reminded that there is a verse in that book of theirs that says, "Be ye doers of the word and not hearers only." So when I see an article that says Obama's historic remarks on LGBT equality, and another article entitled "End Climate Change," and given what the day is today, I cannot help but think, what would it have been for Dr. King to stand on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August of 1963 and talk about that dream and then go home and put his feet up and said, "Well, I have certainly been inspirational and given some aspirational words. Now back to the same old, same old." But he could not have done it, because he was surrounded by too many people who had too much blood, sweat, toil, and tears invested in the struggle to quit. To say, "Well, we've told them what we want. Let's see if they'll give it to us." And so the measure of historic remarks on LGBT equality and the measure of historic remarks on climate change and the measure of remarks about whether or not Appalachian children can know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm, the measure of all of those is the same. The measure is one of whether we leave the words echoing in the air or get down to the gritty business of making them real, of forging from words a kind of social steel that will not rust and will not dull through the passage of time. Shortly after hearing the remarks, and I tweeted about them, shortly after hearing the remarks about Appalachian children, I was reminded, our buddy Andy forwarded along to me a blast email that went out from the Sierra Club. It went out this past Saturday, the 19th of January, and it said, "Dear friend, for many people living near mountaintop removal coal mining sites in Appalachia, the water they are forced to use for bathing, cooking, and even drinking is cloudy, brown, and toxic. Years of mountaintop removal coal mining have buried 2,000 miles of local streams with waste from big coal's destruction. Many of the streams that are left are devoid of life. Well water in the area isn't safe either, and it's making people sick. People living nearby are at a higher risk of cancer and birth defects. More than 4 years ago, President Obama said we needed to find ways to avoid blowing the tops off of mountains. We're still waiting. Tell the Obama administration we can't wait any longer. It's time to act." Wow, this is inspiring, isn't it? During President Obama's first term, the EPA issued some guidelines that encourage coal companies to do more to protect the water in Appalachia. But these guidelines are non-binding. Mining companies and some Appalachian state agencies are doing all they can to fight them. Half measures like these are unacceptable when the health of entire communities is on the line. Man, this is great! Tell President Obama and the EPA that everyone deserves clean water. Urge them to act now to protect Appalachia from mountaintop removal mining. Man, they got to be coming to a point here. I can't wait to get to the end of it. Congress passed the Clean Water Act over 40 years ago so that no one would be forced to drink polluted water. Enforcing the Clean Water Act is something that the Obama administration can do right away without waiting for Congress to bring relief to Americans living near mountaintop removal mining. Holding coal companies accountable for the dangerous pollution is one of the many actions President Obama must take during his second term to secure a clean energy legacy for our children. Please tell President Obama you will measure the clean energy legacy of his presidency by what he does to protect Appalachians from the effects of mountaintop removal. Thanks for all you do to protect the environment. Marianne Hitt, Beyond Coal Campaign Director, Sierra Club. Oops. Because there's not a word in there about the AKE Act. There's not a word in there about a single thing that would actually end mountaintop removal mining. Mountaintop removal coal extraction. My grandfather and my great-grandfather, as well as Agnes's father and grandfather and, well, aunts or uncles, cousins, whatever, all coal miners. What goes on a mountaintop removal site is not mining. It's toxic demolition work. But maybe if we tweak if the EPA tweaks the Clean Water Act, maybe mountaintop, maybe we could get that excess death rate down to 2,000 from 4,000. Wouldn't that be great for the 2,000 who aren't excess deaths? Tough shit for the people who are still 2,000 excess deaths, but the ones who aren't, well, good for them, huh? A separate peace is no peace at all. Saying it's okay to poison some but not others is not an end to poison. Saying that we can keep some Appalachian children safe from harm but damn others to perdition is no answer. Oh, and by the way, all that business in there about water, it's absolutely true. But here's a little thing to think about. You can live 30 days or so, maybe more, without food. You can live maybe 3 days without water. Try to live 3 minutes without air. Because see, what's absent from all of that is the fact that it is the air, it's the crap in the air, it's the micro-particulated filth and dust that is reduced by the explosions to barely the size of a virus and goes deep into the lungs. It's the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that are the product of incomplete combustion that go into the air and into the soil and keep people from being able to eat fresh garden foods or fruit that grows on tree and vine. That kills with equal effectiveness, but somehow it didn't make it into the text of that email. Oh, well. And apparently, I was not the only one listening to the address with a certain amount of, or with an ear for textual criticism. Everybody who signed up to receive emails from 350 got an email today from Bill McKibben. Good man, Bill McKibben. Mighty good man. Tireless worker. With roots in Appalachia, I might add. He sent out an email today that said, here's what President Obama said about climate change during his address today. We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. Bill McKibben responds as follows. With words like that, it's easy to let ourselves dream that something major might be about to happen to fix the biggest problem the world has ever faced. But we know that even if the president is sincere in every syllable, he's going to need lots of backup to help him get his point across in a city dominated by fossil fuel interests. And given the record of the last 4 years, we know that too often rhetoric has yielded little in the way of results. He's setting up for an event. Bill McKibben says, that's why we need you very badly to take a trip to our nation's capital on February 17th. We'll gather on the National Mall in what is shaping up to be the largest environmental rally in many years. Together we'll send the message loud and clear. If you're serious about protecting future generations from climate change, stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. If you can do that, Mr. President, we can all work together to help build a climate legacy that will be a credit to your critical 8 years in office. Bill McKibben is hoping to get at least 20,000 people on the National Mall on February 17th. You can go to 350.org. to sign up. It's apparently under the heading President's Day. Now, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be in Wisconsin on the 16th of February, but maybe, just maybe, if I get on a plane, I can be back in time for that. Because it's worth it. Dr. John enjoys the ancient history. Thank you. He said, bring it on. Not sarcastic. And then getting on board with the whole Shakespeare thing, Dr. John said, Jan Boner has a lean and hungry look. Let me have men about me that are fat, sleek-headed men and such as sleep a-nights. Dr. John asks, does that mean a promotion for Chris Christie? Kevin, writing from Colorado Springs, says, do you know which congresspersons you're going to see tomorrow and or Wednesday? Well, not tomorrow, but Wednesday and Thursday. We have a couple of meetings already scheduled, and then we're going to be doing some cold calling, so no. But if you are, it does not matter if we knock on the door. If you call your member of Congress, tell them the AIC Act is coming. Tell them to get in touch with John Yarmuth of Kentucky's office. This is the House. To sign on and protect Appalachia's children. Yeah, one phone call won't make it. I mean, sometimes if you've got If you've got a really good responsive member of Congress, one phone call might do it. But generally it doesn't. It takes persistence. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. But if you will then in turn email me, bobkincaid@gmail.com, bobkincaid@gmail.com, let us know who you've contacted, and we will follow up as we have been. Because it's going to be a struggle. Tim from L.A. just sent me a little snippet. He said, the right wing is pissed that Obama may regulate MTR. I got the story from the Looney Mooney rag, Washed Up Times, the Washington Times. It was a piece titled, Obama Coal Regulations Crippling Communities. It was dated Friday, January 18th, 2013. The war on jobs and affordable energy is real and continues to pick up steam with a swarm of new regulations coming out of President Obama's Environmental Protection Agency, contributing to more mine closures and plant shutdowns across the country. Last week, we witnessed the latest round of victims in the war on coal, with Georgie Power Company announcing its plans to shutter 15 fossil fuel-fired electric units, impacting nearly 500 jobs in the state. So once again, these poor, money-grubbing fools persist in trying to argue that toxic jobs doing toxic work are more important than children's lives. That's a losing argument. Because there aren't just many workaday Americans out there who think that a job is more important than a child. You realize that there are more jobs now in wind, there are more jobs now in solar than there are in coal? Saw a fascinating article over the weekend. It was an excerpt from a magazine. From Men's Journal, I think. About something, a remark. Yeah, there it is. Men's Journal. Here's the operative snippet. Coal accounts for 41% of the world's energy and remains the number one source of climate change emissions. In the past 4 years, new environmental regulations on power plants, increased incentives for wind, and low natural gas prices have resulted in a 13% decrease in coal's portion of domestic energy use. But we can accelerate that trend. And here's a quote. Coal is just criminal. Every aspect of its extraction, distribution, and deployment costs lives and imposes health impacts and huge costs. Burton Richter is a Nobel laureate in physics. He says, you could pension off all the 80,000 workers in the coal industry for a tiny fraction of the medical bills due to burning coal. That includes the birth defects of children who have not even emerged from the womb. That includes the grandfather who never gets to take his grandkids up the holler fishing, or teaching them how to hunt, or to dig ginseng or slippery elm bark, or how to find morels in the spring, or dig for ramps, or any of the myriad other things that grandmas and grandpas do for grandkids, that mothers and fathers do. The Men's Journal article says, in advance of the quote from Burton Richter, "For those who think cutting coal is too expensive in a recession, we must recognize the massive $60 billion annual health costs associated with burning this fossil fuel, everything from cardiovascular and respiratory illness to premature death." And that $60 billion annual estimate, that's an annual estimate that is conservative, to say the least. It can be done. Pension off all the 80,000 workers in the coal industry for a tiny fraction of the medical bills. It can happen. Thank you. Thank you to Brian for the first contribution that has come in of the evening. It is much appreciated. Even though we go on the road, we do still keep paying bills. That's one of the miracles of the internet. You can still find people to pay bills to, even if you're not at home. And just by way of a little bit more scheduling information, we hope to be on the air tomorrow evening, but that's not a for sure. For sure is Tuesday evening and Wednesday evening and Thursday evening. No, this is Monday, isn't it? No, for sure is Wednesday evening and Thursday evening. On Friday, I'm in the air. Won't be home until Monday evening. And that's going to... But then we'll still be in D.C. when I get back. So we will have broadcasts on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. And then on Thursday and Friday, we have the... We have the Radio Row for Families USA, and that will be chock-a-block with healthcare information that I think you will find both fascinating and useful. And many thanks to the folks at Families USA for the kind invitation to come and participate. After that, the schedule gets weird. I don't know if I'm flying into I'm flying to Wisconsin out of Charleston or out of D.C. That remains to be seen. Cassie writes in, our own Cassie at college, with the subject line, "A little quibble about the inauguration speech." "I enjoyed," Cassie says, "today's inauguration, and especially the speeches, but though I also thought there was too much preaching. Compared to your complaints about Obama pretending to care for the children of Appalachia, my complaint is tiny, but it exists. President Obama today said, 'For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts.' What about," says Cassie, "what about we women who are not wives or mothers or daughters? Does he ever refer to men as husbands, fathers, and sons?" "No, those are the our, O-U-R, implicit in the sentence I quoted above. Still a lot of work to do." Signed, Cassie. P.S., Cassie says, "Did you watch Maddo on Friday? She says she's planning to be at every inauguration until 2040, so she'll be covering mine in 2032. Turn straight, and I hope I'm there. I damn sure want a good seat. Man, what a crowd that was. And yet it was a smaller crowd. It's still almost too much for Washington, D.C. to handle. I have a feeling, had we been there, we would have wound up being more or less confined to quarters, so to speak. Because I don't think you could move around much on Capitol Hill. And I don't, you know, I don't know, I don't necessarily know that I think that the president was pretending to care about the children of Appalachia. I think he does in a sort of academic way. But it's the transfer of caring from being an academic thought exercise to being the visceral crisis that it is in an everyday life. That's the telling part. Kevin writes, having heard me read the blast from the Sierra Club, he says, also, right after Marianne hit director of the Beyond Coal campaign, on the note comes the usual please donate part of the email, and the Sierra Club is not only the ones are not the only ones to do it. It begs the question, in my mind anyway, says Kevin, of what was the real reason for sending the blast email, to get people to sign on to the campaign, or was it only sent to receive donations? Sorry for writing again, Kevin says, but this practice aggravates me to no end. I'm fairly sure that a lot of these organizations don't realize the impression their emails leave, but it reminds me a little too much of certain Christian faith leaders' ways of asking for money. I know. And that's probably part of the reason that, you know, the AIC campaign toddles along on very little. We've gotten tremendous help from the wonderful people at Earth Justice. And we've gotten some financial help from individual contributors. But a lot of us have pumped efforts into it that have come out of our own pockets. It could be considerably easier to get this bill passed with a little bit of help. And by a little bit of help, I don't discount for a moment the work that all of you have done. You know what I mean when I say a little bit of help. You know, not sweating the rent. That kind of thing. A lot of wear and tear goes on tires going back and forth. Wear and tear on automobiles. Wear and tear on one's own hide. But it's work that has to be done. And we have waited a long time for the folks who constantly tell us how smart they are to come up with a solution to mountaintop removal. That solution has not been forthcoming. And so that's how the AIC Act came to be. We hillbillies got tired of sitting around waiting while the smart people decided what should happen to our lives. And did what hillbillies have almost always had to do, and that is take care of ourselves. You know, that's one of the reasons Appalachian people are an easy joke. Our houses are cobbled together. Our cars are unattractive. Sometimes rusty. Sometimes we've got a couple of parts cars up on blocks in the side yard for when the water pump goes out or the alternator has to be replaced. But they go. Sometimes the roof leaks. Sometimes the furnace goes out. But we've managed to survive on a lot of grit for no small amount of time with the background music of a nation that chuckles at our quirky ways. Right? Yeah. So I will ask by way of opening up the conversation. I will ask if anything out of the inaugural today struck you as particularly meaningful or objectionable or inspiring. We've heard from Ron and Raleigh. We've heard from Cassie. And the floor is open to you. You know the number. 304-658-3333. And you know the email address. Bob Kincaid. BobKincaid @gmail.com. And either way gets you in just fine. Skype is also open. The Skype handle is Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. And you can get into the program and into the conversation that way too. And Lord knows there's a big old ongoing stack to get into, because it is not lost upon me here at about 7 minutes past the hour that this is also Moran Monday. And we've got some. I said when reading the passage from the president's inaugural address, and he made reference to, what was it, from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall. Well, we've got a Moran nomination out of that. You won't be surprised who it is. It is, of course, Flush Flimball. It's the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birth, the national holiday we celebrate, of his entirely too short life. And Flimball himself he wouldn't feel right if he didn't mark it as well.
Now let's get to what he said to Al Sharpton. It reminds me, and this is about the Second Amendment fight, and who these people are that don't want to give up their guns. Who these people are that want to remain devoted to the Second Amendment. Who are these people that are defending the Second Amendment? In Brokaw's eyes, you people who are devoted to the Constitution are the equivalent of Bull Connor and the Klan. It's senseless. It's illogical. Brokaw said it reminds me a lot of what happened in the South during the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement. How? How does the government making moves here, various elected officials and public interest groups and gobs and other people trying to infringe on a constitutional right. How is that a reminder of what happened in the civil rights era. If that analogy were true, the modern equivalence of the Civil Rights Act is that you people defending and loyal to the Second Amendment are not the Bull Connors. You're the Martin Luther Kings. You're the people marching at Selma. You're having your civil rights denied, or there are people who want to deny you your civil rights. African Americans back then had civil rights denied to them, right? That's why they were marching. You are engaging in activist behavior, and you're buying guns to try to maintain a civil right that is granted you in the Constitution. If anybody is a Bull Connor in this regard, if anybody is the authorities letting loose the dogs and trying to deny you your civil rights, the government. Anybody with a brain can figure that out. But Brokaw doesn't see it that way at all. He says good people stayed in their houses and didn't speak up when there was carnage in the streets. And the total violation of the fundamental rights of African Americans as they marched in Selma. So those of you who are not mobilizing to change the Second Amendment, those of you who are not mobilizing to make it more difficult to get guns and weapons are the modern equivalent of people who sat around and let Bull Connor turn his dogs loose on the marchers at Selma. Man, I
just want to point something out. If Dr. John is still with us, and a number of other people who are familiar with the history of the civil rights movement, they're screaming right now. Did you catch that? Bull Connor. Who was Bull Connor? I'm not in a preaching mood. Who was Bull Connor? Because Limbaugh just said Bull Connor at Selma. Bull Connor was the commissioner of public safety for the city of Birmingham, I'm sorry. What the hell? I've been away from home too long. Birmingham. His actions were in Birmingham. The history of the civil rights movement is not even important enough to this flatulent swine. And, of course, most of his whiter than a bar of Irish soap audience doesn't know the difference either, but I couldn't let that go.
The on the marchers at Selma. Not mobilizing to make it more difficult to get guns and weapons are the modern equivalent of people who sat around and let Bull Connor turn his dogs loose on the marchers at Selma. Man, the foundation of what you must believe to be this out of phase. And then he said they let Bull...
There's that goddess of irony again.
Bull Connor and the redneck elements of the South and the Klan take over their culture, in effect, to become a face of it. Now, Bull Connor and these guys are all Democrats. But you, in Tom Brokaw's eyes, you who are trying to defend a civil right that you have by virtue of the Constitution are the modern equivalent of people who denied civil rights to blacks in the 60s, in Tom Brokaw's view. And that has governed the way he sees this country ever since it happened. And a lot of other journalists, too. Try this. If a lot of African Americans back in the 60s had guns...
Now, wait a minute.
...and a legal right to...
I got to back up. We got to get ready for this. Because, see, we've already addressed the what if all the slaves had guns issue. And, you know, Flush Flembaugh, he doesn't exactly want to... I mean, he doesn't want to retread... what was his name? Larry Ward or whatever that goober's name was. doesn't want to retread over it. No. Flynn Ball's an independent thinker. So when he's going to say some crazy shit, he's going to say his own crazy shit. Here we go.
Try this. If a lot of African Americans back in the 60s had guns and the legal right to use them for self-defense, you think they would have needed Selma? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah, he don't know. He's just asking. But finish what passes for a thought in the thin gray settlings that slosh about between your porcine ears, Flush.
If John Lewis, who says he was beat upside the head...
Wait, did you catch that? Did you catch the descent into a race-baiting voice? Did you catch the use of language? Who says he was beat upside the head? Not who was beaten upside the head. Textual criticism, I'm telling you, it's going to be big.
If John Lewis, who says he was beat upside the head,
did you hear that? There's not a day in Flush Flimball's life when describing such a situation he would ever say, beat upside the head. Nor would he say it in that fashion. It is open mockery. Of the slaughter that presaged the march from Selma to Montgomery, and of the brutal violence that attended it.
Oh, I'm just asking. If John Lewis, who says he was beat upside the head, if John Lewis had had a gun, would he have been beat upside the head on the bridge? Anyway, that's what we're... And these people that think like Brokaw are all over the media. This is the way they're looking at this.
You got it? But you know the history of the Selma to Montgomery March. You know that it was born out of a young African-American man's desire to stop an assault upon his parents. You know that that was an attempt at what the law respects as defense of others. And you know that a cop turned and put a bullet through him for his efforts. And that it was his body that initially they planned to carry from the doors of the church across the Edmund Pettus Bridge all the way to the State House in Montgomery, Alabama. I'm hard-pressed. And perhaps it's not necessary for me to fully address that. This whole thing is a rant about guns. The abiding fear of the white South has always been of a so-called race war. That's why, at least in part, the South is so gunned up in the first place. Paranoia. paranoia. But in Limbaugh's sick and possibly syphilitic brain, there never should have been a civil rights movement. An armed group of African Americans, oppressed as they were, should have turned and fired on the police, whether it be Bull Connor at Birmingham or the state Alabama state police, state troopers at Selma. At which point, Bloody Sunday would not have just been bloody. It would have been an outright massacre. And that would have been fine with Flush Flimball, because he don't care much for uppityness anyway. It tells you precisely what Limbaugh doesn't know about nonviolence. It tells you exactly what he does not know about the mission and the teachings and the preachings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Having been mocked by this tub of guts, Limbaugh, John Lewis responded. He said, "Our goal in the civil rights movement was not to injure or to destroy, but to build a sense of community, to reconcile people to the true oneness of all humanity." African Americans in the 60s could have chosen to arm themselves, but we made a conscious decision not to. We were convinced that peace could not be achieved through violence. Violence begets violence, and we believed the only way to achieve peaceful ends was through peaceful means. Texas Betsy pointing out, you could not possibly expect Flush to know anything about nonviolence, nor of the history of the civil rights movement. Well, you know, February, the shortest month of the year, is after all Black History Month, so maybe he can take one of those days and, you know, maybe get himself a Viagra prescription, head down to the Dominican Republic, troll himself up a few little for sale boys, and in the interims, maybe he can read up. Yeah, folks just need to be shooting back. And to use the civil rights movement as an argument for paranoid white people to start engaging in treasonous conduct against the government of we, the people of these United States, there's a reason we call this dirty little bastard a part of Radio Rwanda. So we'll take a little break. They're getting ready to go. I guess the balls are all starting up in D.C. and, you know, men in tuxes and women in gowns and dancing and nobody going much of anywhere, because the city is practically choked into a state of absolute immobility at this point, except for people who can get places via motorcade. And inaugurations are, by their very definition, yes, aspirational, but they also lay out a vision. And for some of us, the vision is one of work to be done, dreams to be made reality. And for the other, for another sad, separate, paranoid, weirded out group. They dream of the day. What do they dream of? Or are they just entirely consumed by that paranoia? Listener supported, This is the Horn. Conversation radio begins in a matter of moments. 304-658-3333. Bob Kincaid, BOBKINCAID at gmail.com is the email address. Take a little break. We'll be right back.
Met a girl called Lola and I took her back to my place. Feeling guilty, feeling scared, hidden cameras everywhere. Stop! Hold on. Stay in control.
Destruction, lies, accusers, stop the
And that's how it goes. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. We are halfway through this Moran Monday edition with a pretty strong contender for Moran Monday's ultimate winner in Flush Flimball there and his, you know, if only John Lewis had had a... Oh, my God. Will from Chicago is with us via Skype. Hey, Will.
Hi. Since Rush nominally claims to be a Republican, let me quote a great Republican named Abraham Lincoln. Better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. I believe that Mr. Limbaugh has long ago removed all doubt, but he's merely reinforced it. First.
Yeah, but he does, he does prove that apparently stupidity pays very, very well.
Well, actually, it is more being a sycophant for business interests and getting out a political agenda that they like. I mean, I find it odd that Rush Limbaugh criticized Monica Lewinsky for doing to Bill Clinton what Mr. Limbaugh himself does to the Koch brothers and other corporate interests, namely servicing them and helping them make loud noises. I think that for me, one of the big moments in the whole inauguration speech was when the president took on Paul Ryan directly with a remark about the takers and that we have to get here together as a nation. Let's remember that the modern Republican belief is that we are a nation of individuals, not a community. And this is what was stressed over and over again during the presidential election by the Republicans. People who were not contributing were takers, never mind the fact that the vast majority of Americans enjoy some form of government benefit, either in taxes, mortgage write-offs, or out of the fact that many areas we have clean air and roads. More on the clean air a bit later. So I think the president has tried to define some core beliefs, and to my delight, Charles Krauthammer called this the end of the Reagan Revolution. And if it is so, I will say amen in a loud voice.
Well, and good riddance.
And good riddance, because Reagan, Thatcher, et al. Implemented the theories of Milton Friedman, which, if they were a medical theory, can best be likened to bloodletting. Does not make sense in any way, shape, or form. So I think that there was much promising in the speech. Would I have wanted more? Yes. For one thing, we spend too much on the military-industrial complex. Our wars in Afghanistan, I have to ask if our actions there and in neighboring Pakistan are creating more terrorists than they are stopping. And by the way, even Donald Rumsfeld, he of the weird phrasing, wondered this. But I think overall it's a good speech, but in the end, the president is going to need support and pressure for any positive agenda. Why? One, there are lots of loud voices in the room. Tomorrow you will be trying to counter those who are attached to King Cole and raising their voices and raising their dollars. And I do urge every listener to please petition their congressmen and senators to support the Appalachian, the Apache Act, simply because it is a disaster. You can no more raise a child to be healthy in an area poisoned by chemicals and dust than you can expect to lock a seedling from a plant in a closet, never give it water, and expect it to bloom. So I think there's a lot to do, but we are reminded by the speech that we have only gotten anywhere in this country by acting as a community. And as the Horn is a wonderful community, It's one of many places to organize, and one of the many reasons why, if you can't support the horn tonight, please do so. But also, contact your senators, contact your congressmen, lobby them, and also don't forget the down ticket races. I mean, today's county board person might be the person you're voting for Congress in a few years. And don't forget the precinct captain. That's how the Tea Party took over the GOP. They pretty much put all their own people in as precinct captains.
Well, so they made a very deliberate attempt, Will.
Exactly.
To win little pissant legislative races in states. And that's a lot cheaper than winning congressional races.
Exactly. Because once you win those little races, you have clout inside the state.
Well, you don't just have clout. Once you get a majority, Will, you get to redraw the district maps.
Exactly.
That's how it wound up that more Americans voted for Democratic members of the House than voted for Republicans, and yet Republicans still have the majority.
Right, and I think we forget about local races at our peril. I mean, I look at it this way. Even the best Major League Baseball teams need good farm teams. And that's one of the things that our lower level races do. But a lot of what happens locally impacts us a lot. So I'm hoping that what we see after this speech is a greater commitment from people to take a stand, take action, and move forward. Because I believe the Republicans are afraid. This is why their rhetoric is becoming more and more stressed and crazy. I mean, we have people bringing up the issue of secession and impeachment in public, and I think we know what they are likely bringing up in private, as you alluded to in referring to Cassius, Brutus, and Cato. So we have to be at our best and realize there are people and corporations who are playing for keeps. We have to do it ourselves. And as for Limbaugh's whole gun argument, I found an interesting article in Salon by Alex Seidwald where it turns out someone at Fox News who was writing about the Holocaust decided that during the Warsaw Uprising, which was an example of courageous resistance if you had it, only 20 Germans were killed while some 13,000 Jews were massacred. And it would not have mattered if everyone who had been denied gun rights in Germany were not. Simply because there was an expansion of gun ownership. So once again, the right wing comes up with a false meme, but then again, these are the people who try to call Hitler a socialist when he was anything but. So I think we have our work cut ahead of us, but in the long run, I am optimistic. Why? It isn't so much faith in a politician, it's faith in ourselves. And the willingness to do the hard work. And I see that happening in a lot of places. So even though we can be cynical and we can despair, we must choose to act, because if we don't, who's going to act? Who's going to advocate for the children of Appalachia, Detroit, the rougher neighborhoods of Chicago and many other cities? Who will speak for the children in Newtown, Connecticut? It has to be us. Because if it isn't us, who's it going to be? Rush Limbaugh? Please. This is a man who is so in love with himself that if someone told me that every room in his house was mirrored from floor to ceiling, I would not be shocked.
Ew.
But, yes. Well,
I didn't
need
that visual, Will.
Well, either that or saying that I care so little for the man that if demons came to claim his soul and roasted marshmallows over his charred remains after he took the last OxyContin on the planet, I would not object. But seriously, we have to realize that what any tyranny fears is a motivative and active citizenry. This is why Occupy Wall Street was mocked and insulted. This is why you had people mocking the gay rights movement, the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement. Why? Because there are people who invested in seeing us view ourselves as powerlessness, as powerless. And if we view ourselves as having powerlessness and the wealthy having all the power.
Well, I tell you what, Will. I mean, if anything, I hope that people understand that the AIC campaign and the AIC Act are a direct refutation of that. Because
exactly.
We did. We really did, Will. We sat around waiting for the smart people to figure out how to end mountaintop removal, and mostly all they did was fundraise on us.
Right. In the end, we have to take the power into our own hands. Why not citizen activity? Why not activists pressing their demands while someone out there is figuring out an alternative to coal? And there are lots of good alternatives out there. I mean, honestly, a more logical civilization at this point would probably have switched to renewable energy, particularly with our global climate going all over the map. I mean, I am sitting in Chicago land tonight. It's -10. We have had virtually no snow this season, and on Saturday it was about 50 degrees. So we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to act in our own best interests and the interests of our society and our world? I think the answer is yes. And when we see more of that happening, you will see the Rush Limbaughs, the Eric Cantors, the John Boners and Mitch McConnells become more crazed and frantic, but hopefully become ultimately irrelevant. It's when we realize our own power to shape our destinies and shape our world that true change comes. That is the message that Dr. King, who we honor on this day, reminded us of always, that we do have the power to change the world. It's an awesome power, and let us use it wisely. But let us never deny that we lack power to change both ourselves and the world around us. I think the inaugural speech touched on that. But if we want change, we can't just rely on some politician to bring it to us from on high. We're going to have to demand it and be loud about it. There's an old saying that FDR once met with some labor leaders and agreed with their proposals and said, "Well, I agree with everything you say, guys. Now you have to force me to do it.
Now make me do it, right.
Make me do it. Why? Because even the best intentioned person, and there's no way I can read Barack Obama's mind, sorry people, I'm not from Mars, I has to deal with the political forces that be. There's a lot of money in politics, there's a lot of people whose first allegiance seems to be to their corporate backers. But when there are enough people to demand change, even the people who are fence sitters will say, you know, I really like my job, I'm going to vote for this and please the people. And similarly, a president can go to those same fence sitters and say, well, look at it this way. You either support this or you know you're going to get a primary challenge. And guess what? I'm not going to become involved in any primaries in your district. Again, I think Obama does need to improve a lot. He needs to be more resolute than he has been in the past. I think he's kind of learned that lesson, because the GOP, as it now stands, is willing to obstruct and block any proposal and truly doesn't care if we enter a recession. I mean, consider this.
one of the things that was before you go on, Will, one of the things that was pointed out was that this is also the fourth anniversary. This is the fourth anniversary of Barack Obama's first inauguration, but it is also the fourth anniversary of that high-level meeting that took place at a steakhouse in D.C. and is borne out. And I can't remember the book right now. I apologize. But is borne out in writing, in real live, honest-to-God reporting, of when Mitch McConnell and a handful of others got together and made a determination that even if Barack Obama proposed a law that said kittens should be rescued from burning trees, that they would oppose it. That they would oppose everything up to and including his being president.
They would oppose him for breathing air. And honestly,
what did we hear from the for-profit media? Because I did hear it. I happened to in the few moments before I switched over. I know I'm shallow. To watch the NFL playoffs yesterday, I caught a rerun of Meet the Prestitutes, and I heard
it Eat the Press. Because
I heard that same tired line of drivel about how President Obama is too much above the fray and that he hasn't gone down and rubbed elbows and spit in the spit tunes with the Republicans and played flip with them and a little mumbly peg here and there, you know, and been all social with them, you know, like other presidents was.
Well, honestly, I think he should know by this point they don't want him there, and honestly, it's all about power with them. I mean, good heavens. This is a Republican Party that would have no place for Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, or Dwight Eisenhower, who would be considered either too much of compromisers or too far to the left. Now, think about that statement for a moment. The icon of the Republican Party, based on his record of raising taxes and compromising, would not be able to have been elected in the primaries this last go around. These Republicans are not interested in compromise. And there's a rule. You can't compromise with someone who's idea of compromise is you surrender to me absolutely.
But scorched earth is all they've got now, the Republican Party.
Yep, I'm afraid so. I mean, honestly,
let's be kind of candid about all of this, Will. Do you see any evidence whatsoever to indicate that when the House gets back down to business tomorrow, that they're going to be changed, that they're going to be transformed, that the aspirational rhetoric of the speech today is somehow going to have made them into different people? Because I don't.
Honestly, I don't think they would listen to the voice of the Almighty and a burning bush and a choir of angels. But what we can do is just try to rally what support we can for good causes and try to work around them, and if the GOP blocks anything, we just expose it, we highlight it, so that even if all we get is block after block after block, then in 2014, we just show the record and remind the American people and keep the pressure on. And that, I think, is going to be the hardest thing, because we are going to get frustrated with the Republicans again and again, but I think they are going to show their true colors, and they are going to continue blocking, and even if not very little happens in these next 2 years, we can still make sure that we keep a record and we try to hold them accountable so that hopefully in the future we can get things done. That is, I think, one of the grave problems with our country, namely that we have a party that, instead of offering alternatives, merely doesn't believe in government anymore. When they do offer policies, it's things that have failed. The austerity budgets, Paul Ryan and his ilk.
Well, can I point out one other thing, too, please, Will?
Sure.
And that is this. You know, we've talked about 2010, we've talked about gerrymandering, we've talked about redrawing the congressional maps. At some point in time, it sure would be nice to see an apology letter go out from Rahm Emanuel to Howard Dean saying, wow, if we'd taken your 50-state strategy seriously, they might not have been able to gerrymander themselves into a majority that they could not have otherwise held in 2012.
Well, Rahm Emanuel apologizing is about as likely as hell freezing over and the demons and devils forming different hockey leagues. I don't think you will ever have him do so, but if we had kept up the 50-state strategy, we could be in a much better place. But we didn't. And again, this is a lot of the problem with the Democratic Party. By its nature, it's a coalition party that in most other countries would be a couple different parties. But we have to just keep our eye on the long haul because it seems that the GOP has tunnel vision, and I'm afraid that what we're all going to see is a repeat of the past few years. But that doesn't mean we give up. Rather, this means we take names, we let people know, oh, by the way, your congressman was one of the people who blocked these things that I understand you're really in favor of. So we have our work cut out for us one way or another. It isn't easy, but what else can we do except to work hard? I don't expect miracles. I expect that if we do our hard work, that maybe we can make some progress. If not this Congress, then the next Congress. But what we can do is get out there, support bills that are needed, such as Archie, and go ahead for it. And if they block, we hold them accountable. And not to give up. That is, I think, one thing that we got from Dr. King and other members of the Civil Rights Movement. Even when it looked the worst, they did not give up. And let's remember that before Dr. King, there were many others laboring in that field from the 1910s onward. So we have to be in it for the long haul because our adversaries are in it for the long haul as well.
Well, they are. And they don't plan on giving up, do they?
They will not give up until they are voted out of office and are perhaps forced to go the way of the Whigs, to which I will gladly say that is almost where the GOP is, because like the Whigs in the 1850s, they really aren't generating any ideas, and they also notice that their support is going down and down as fewer people identify as Republican, as demographic change is altering America. So I have hope for the short term, but more in the long term. And we have to be scrappy fighters who aren't going to give up ever, because I don't see Paul Ryan giving up. I don't see Eric Cantor, John Boehner, and Mitch McConnell or their backers giving up and going away. And we have to get up each day, realize we're in it for the long haul. It's going to be a struggle. We'll have defeats and we'll have victories. But in the end, I will agree with Dr. King that the arch of history bends towards freedom. And let us hope justice as well.
Thanks, Will. Thank you very kindly. Well said indeed. You have a good night, all right?
Have a good night.
Take care. Will, calling from Chicago on the Skype line. The Skype line is now open, as are the regular phone lines, 304-658-3333. I've been thinking much today about 4 years ago I guess it was about this time I was wandering onto Capitol Hill through the press and maze of people. If you want to go back and hear the account of that, it's in the archives sometime after the 20th day of January when I was back behind the microphone. Quite an adventure, that. It's my first opportunity hanging out with the almost indescribable, certainly matchless, Guy James. Because we had there was a forum for progressive broadcasters the following day, hosted by the Senate Progressive Caucus. And it was something to behold. That would have been January 2009. But in regard to what Will was saying about the other side, I thought you might find this little snippet interesting. This is a press release from Americans for Prosperity. That, of course, is the Teabag Front Group that is a wholly owned subsidiary of, well, the worst elements of the financial forces behind the Republican Party. Dateline, AFP responds to President Obama's inaugural address. A statement from AFP President Tim Phillips. Dateline, Arlington, Virginia. Americans for Prosperity, the nation's foremost advocate for economic freedom. Really? Responded to President Obama's inaugural address with a statement from AFP President Tim Phillips. Now, this is the part where you open up the bottle of whatever your favorite poison is, as it were. Brown liquor, clear liquor, gold liquor, hookah. Because it's gonna take something to get through this. You know how we've been talking about how it was all a speech was all, you know, aspirational and everything except Abraham Lincoln talking about the better angels of our nature, right? Even the lines, and I've got them here, even the lines about the pioneers and walking in footsteps that had been trod before, and yeah, it's supposed to lift your spirits and make you think higher, deeper, more inspired things than just the gritty business of toiling in the trenches day after day against an implacable, entrenched foe. Hell-bent on burning this country all the way to cinders as long as it means that one doesn't get his way, okay? You're supposed to get beyond that. We're supposed to think happy thoughts and, right, and, you know, we have there are parties in D.C. and blah, 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 blah. Well, not over at Americans for Prosperity, the teabaggers. Here's what Tim Phillips said. For generations, presidents have used inaugural addresses to unite the nation by reaffirming our democratic traditions and touching on broad aspiration themes. Disappointingly, President Obama chose to deliver a harshly ideological, aggressively partisan speech more appropriate for the campaign trail than for the solemn occasion of his inaugural ceremony. His address read like a liberal laundry list with global warming at the top. Americans have rejected environmental extremism in the past, and they will again. I guess what that's what we call it when we sit idly by and allow little hillbilly children to be poisoned to death. That's rejecting environmental extremism. Americans for Prosperity will certainly be in the vanguard of the effort to oppose the president's big government policies that spend too much
and regulate too much, and as a consequence are failing to get our economy moving again.
I think Tim Phillips would do well to leave the brown acid alone. Because we're fairly clear-minded, aren't we? Clear-headed, all jokes about getting out the brown liquor and everything aside. We saw that address today. It was not exactly a call to the barricades. It wasn't up against the wall, you redneck mothers, directed at the right wing. Any president in history has had the right, in an inaugural address, to make a vision statement for himself and the means by which he perceived the country he was elected, and someday, hopefully, she will be elected to lead. But not that one. You know, he didn't say the word global warming once. He said climate change. The right wing's already chased us away from the ability to use global warming. We have to use their phrase, climate change, to make them happy. Yeah. Does that statement tell you everything you need to know about that gang of astroturfed, highly coke-funded weirdos with their stupid tri-cornered hats and their idiotic misunderstanding of an event, of a terroristic event in Boston Harbor more than 200 years ago? Doesn't that tell you everything you could possibly want to know? Good God. They're not opposing Barack Obama. They're opposing the Barack Obama that exists in their fetid and paranoid imaginations. They're not opposing the Barack Obama that bent over backwards for Wall Street during the height of the financial crisis. They're opposing some Barack Obama that exists in some sort of Star Trek alternate universe where he's working every day to be a little more FDR-like. Good God. But if that's not a clear signal, because, see, Tim Phillips would not have gotten to say that if it had not been approved all the way up to the offices of the Kochs or the Roves or any other of those half-mad freaks that run the old paranoid Southern White Party. So, no. Take a moment. Enjoy the moment. But understand that this is very much about like that joke about the man's first day in hell. He's offered a choice of two rooms. In one room, everybody's standing on their head for all eternity on a concrete floor, and he can hear the moanings from the persistent migraines and the pain that attends that eternity. He's offered a choice between that room and the next room that he sees, where everybody's standing together knee-deep in shit drinking coffee. And so he chooses the room where people are standing knee-deep in shit drinking coffee, and he no sooner gets a coffee cup in his hand than a little demon runs in and says, coffee break's over, back on your heads. Tomorrow, coffee break's over, back on your heads. Or better yet, tomorrow, coffee break's over, back to work. Andy just wrote in, he said, so, corporate media says Barack not yucking it up enough with the boys, huh? He says, Mr. Bob, I heard your comment that Mr. Obama is not pressing the flesh enough with the Republicans. So the corporate media thinks he's not drinking enough beers, yucking it up on the golf course. Please. The latest count I've had, he played 134 rounds of golf in his first term, near a White House record. I'm in the camp you refer to often. I believe this guy really is carrying out his neoliberal agenda. He's a right-of-center corporate Republican, anti-working class and anti-union, and damn proud of it. But, you know, we get a sop thrown to us periodically full of high-blown, high-flown, highfalutin, pretty language, and we hope that it's real. And then we realize we can hope in one hand and in the other one and see which one fills up first. There was highfalutin rhetoric about the sanctity of Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, and yet there was David Gregory on that same stupid program yesterday talking about how we've got to have entitlement reform. Charlie Pierce over at Esquire blog refers to him as bringing the pain to granny. We're not out of the woods. He won't truly be a lame duck until after the 2014 congressional midterms. You want to get any work done, you best be working on it now. Just say. So there really are more nominees and we'll get to them in the next hour. Or your calls, 304-658-3333. I want to extend a special thank you. We actually are far closer this evening than we were before to meeting the evening's fundraising goal. We are now only $32 away. So thanks, Mark, and thanks, Brian, for playing your part in getting us there. We'll take a little break and come back to your calls or our nominations for this More In Monday. This is The Horn, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
So down. You like your life in a freeform style. Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
You know, I hate what has become of the music collection in this tired old computer. That was not supposed to be the Ozark Mountain Daredevils and Jackie Blue, although I love that song. It's just that all the titles are screwed up, and you better count yourself lucky that it wasn't Michael Martin Murphy singing Wildfire, you know, about that horse that gets lost in a killing frost. Frost? Really? My apologies. Maybe we'll get... Because I had it all in my mind. I had it all in my mind, you know, with the parties and everything taking place. And, you know, I had just the right bumper. Wait a minute. Let me see if I've got the right bumper this time. No, oh, Jesus, that was Wildfire. Here it is. Anyway, you get it. And I know that song's been redone a half a dozen times, but nothing ever approaches. That is the original by the Sweet, right? Yeah. Ballroom Blitz. Anyway, something to throw out for your consideration, just in case you were wondering. I mentioned Charles Pierce's blog over at Esquire.com, the politics blog. Probably as good a rundown... I'm just a fan of it. I love good writing. And day in and day out, this is about the best political writing that there is. Certainly beats the snot out of 99.9% of it. But Obama's inauguration speech, a primer, posted today, is a beautiful rundown of what the speech meant. And then I was kind of proud, right there in the last paragraph... He said, "We will wait and see, of course, what happens once the scaffolding and the bunting comes down, bearing in mind always the scriptural caution about faith without works being dead." I didn't read that. I promise I didn't. I didn't read that before citing that very same dadgum doggone verse. But it's the truth. The question is, whose works it is? Whose... We're having grammar troubles right now. Whose works is it? Are it? Anyway, whose works will it take to find out if the ideas can be carried into fruition? Some has to be done by the people who were elected and sent there to do it. Some of us, though, as Will alluded to, has to be done by us. and the question falls as much to us as it does to government. I know that may seem a little bit Pollyanna-ish or Pollyanna-esque. Thank you, Texas Betsy. I knew you'd tell me. Works has become singular, used to be plural. You're right to be confused. Thank you. But the verse says faith without works is dead. But that's a reference that faith is the subject. I'm confused. So anyway, back to in these remaining moments of this Moran Monday. Back to the nominations. And we're just going to kind of march through them in no particular sort of order. But I know, for instance, that there are a lot of us, myself included, when we can afford it, who like to buy organic foods. We like the idea of not eating the pesticides. We like the idea of chickens that are free to come and go out of the coop in between egg laying sessions. We like that. We like to know that we're not eating genetically modified anything, as witness the millions of people who voted in favor of a GMO labeling law just barely failed in California this past election season. And there are stores that are set up to deal in that sort of thing. And they are wildly, wildly successful. One of those stores is Whole Foods. Whole Foods is run by a freak by the name of John Mackey. And this is not the same Mackey who was a running back for, what, the Baltimore Colts? Was it the Colts? I was very young at the time. No, this is a different John Mackey. And, yeah, we do like this kind of stuff. Texas Betsy says, you know, I only buy chickens where I actually know the teenagers who have to feed and care for the chickens. Nice. Kind of makes me think that maybe, but I don't know if I got it in me. And this would just prove me to be some sort of 21st century detached from reality kind of, you know, I understand the reality of wall sockets that extend all the way to mountaintop removal operations. And I understand that meat doesn't come from the grocery store, but my mother used to tell me stories about going out and grabbing a chicken for Sunday dinner and chopping its head off. My poor father would cringe. He was hard-pressed to swat a fly. I think he'd been a giant or something in another life. But I think I got his tender heart. It was just reality. You went, you got the chicken, you chopped its head off, and there you go. Vegans and vegetarians are cringing even as I speak. I'm cringing, too. Now, John Mackey, not too long back, declared that Obamacare is, and these are his words, not mine, like fascism. Okay, Texas Betsy, my father had been a chicken in another life. But no, that it extended well past chickens. He couldn't eat a raw oyster to save him. But John Mackey, who later admitted that, well, you know, saying that Obamacare is like fascism is a bad choice of language. He did not, however, say that it was the wrong thing to say, that he was completely, utterly, and totally wrong, that it has no resemblance to fascism whatsoever, and that he knows the difference between fascism and this. John Mackey is not very good at the first law of holes. And, of course, the first law of holes, as we all know, is that when you are in one, it's best to stop digging. No. He sat down and did an interview with Mother Jones Magazine. This is what he said. And the inaugural address had some words for this kind of person. I believe it did. Here we go. What were those words? I read it earlier from the note from Bill McKibben. The path towards we the people still believe that. Let's just use the audio this time.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations.
Okay, that's all well and good. He said, we will respond to the threat of climate change. Would it have made any difference if he had said, we will respond to the reality of climate change? Because a threat is a violence not yet done. You know, kind of like what the Republicans said, do what we say or the economy gets it. That's a threat. There's a threat implicit in the right-wing National Republican Association, National Rifle Association ad that complains about Secret Service protection for the President and Mrs. Obama's daughters. There's an implied threat there. But a threat is violence that has not yet been done. Ask the people of the lower Ninth Ward, whether they be still in the lower Ninth Ward or still be dispersed across the country, ask them if climate change is a threat or a reality. Ask folks in Far Rockaway if climate change is a threat or a reality. Ask me, after last summer's derecho, whether climate change and freak storms that blow 80 miles an hour across the country and roar like some sort of hell-vented animal across Appalachia, if climate change is a threat or a reality. Would it have made any difference if he had said we will respond to the threat of climate change? But he did say this.
Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms.
Okay. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science. Back to John Mackey. He said, contrary to what has been written about me, I am not a climate change skeptic. Climate change is clearly occurring, and based on what I've read, global temperatures have increased about 1.5 degrees Celsius over the past 150 years. Now it's time to put our privilege hats on, or our privilege earphones, or our privilege sniffers, or whatever it is we need to dope out disgusting degrees of privilege when it's put in front of us and we're told to eat that sandwich with the in the middle of it. We've been in a gradual warming trend since the end of the Little Ice Age in about 1870, said John Mackey, who knows about as much science as hogs know about Sunday suits. And climate change is perfectly natural and not necessarily bad. Not necessarily bad. Then this. Really, really, John, put down the shovel, buddy. In general, most of humanity tends to flourish more when global temperatures are in a warming trend, and I believe, there's that toxic, tortured word, I believe we will be able to successfully adapt to gradually rising temperatures. Robert, hey Robert, you down there in Australia? John Fox, you down there? How y'all coming along with adapting to 120 degrees in the shade? Let us know when you're done adapted, all right? I don't know how you're going to adapt or anything. Maybe you'll evolve little parasols growing out of your heads and little fans at the ends of your fingers just to kind of keep you cool. But please, let us know how that adapting works out. How about the native peoples of the far north that used to have ice and now have water? How's that adapting working out? Are you watching Kevin Costner's Waterworld for tips on let us know how that adapting works out. Mackey continued, what I am opposed to is trying to stop virtually all economic progress because of the fear of climate change. Man, didn't he? Did you see what he just did? Yeah, it's radio, Bob. Nobody saw nothing. Did you hear what he just did? He just set up a straw man and beat the living snot out of it. That straw man didn't have a chance. What I'm opposed to is to try and stop virtually all economic progress through the sphere of climate change. Okay, I'll bite. Who's trying to stop virtually all economic progress? How the hell do we define John Mackey's version of economic progress? Has he been sitting down drinking with the guy from Shell who said that if it gets too miserable down here, we'll all just move to where the climate's not so damn hot anymore? Does John Mackey even know that places like Germany exist, where not only is climate change not stopping all economic progress, but in fact the response to it is fostering economic progress, where people have more money in their pockets at the end of every month because they're not paying some godforsaken, gigantic-ass, centralized, massive unigrid power bill? Does John Mackey know about that? Has John Mackey ever met anybody who's got a job maintaining wind turbines? Has John Mackey ever sat down and broke bread with somebody who works at a solar panel factory? Now, I'm guessing the answer to all of those questions is, oh, hell no. What I am opposed to is trying to stop virtually all economic progress because of the fear of climate change. See, there's that threat thing as opposed to that reality thing. Climate change is not something that's going to happen someday. And then we'll deal with it. You cannot Scarlett O'Hara your way into climate change. I'll worry about it tomorrow. You can't do that because it's already here. You can't worry about what will happen 30 years from now because it turns out the climate science was sadly conservative in its estimations. Now here's John Mackey talking about a little ice age that ended in 1870, right? And it had started, what, the 14th, 13th century? I don't remember. These right-wingers spend so damn much time talking about sunspots and the little ice age. I tune them out after a while. I do. I admit it. But daggum. So he does, you know, implicit in all these statements lies the fact that he doesn't believe, he doesn't accept, he doesn't acknowledge the real science of climate change, because he's still talking about the little ice age, and there's some nitwit out there babbling about sunspots. Wait a minute, I got it right here. I get these things periodically from the right wing. This guy apparently works for Newsmuck or something. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Naturally, it's from Wingnut Daily. F. Michael Maloof is conducting interviews on this topic. Solar flares closing in on Earth. Maybe it is. I mean, these guys are like stop clocks. Maybe they can be right twice a day. But it does not negate a separate reality. No, John Mackey says, what I'm opposed to is trying to stop virtually all economic progress because of the fear of climate change. I would hate to see billions of people condemned to remain in poverty because of climate change fears. How about the ones who are kept there because of climate change denial, John Mackey? What, does he expect to expand Whole Foods across the globe so that those people who come up out of poverty can fight for that, because we're not stifling anything or pretending it doesn't exist? And, well, it'll be bad. Yeah, populations flourish when the climate's heating up. And as soon as they quit being so damn poverty-stricken, they can afford some of that $16 a pound organically fed, hormone-free ground beef that's frozen in their little freezer section. Or maybe a $10 bottle of cruelty-free barley grass juice. This is what privilege looks like. This is what privilege sounds like. Wringing one's hands over the poor who might remain poor because of what? Or somehow positing that he has a means of lifting people out of poverty by what? Fracking? The Tar Sands XL pipeline? Is that the economic progress that he's talking about? Because I'm not aware of any other economic progress being stifled by trying to address the daggum realities of climate change. Holy... How many people have to die in floods? How many people have to float face down in the backwater of a storm? How many people have to freeze in power outages brought on by nothing so complicated, any more complicated than a wet, heavy snow? Before the John Mackeys of the world say, you know, we've got a problem. Because, see, John Mackey has millions of dollars, and I'm sure he's more than happy to spend some of it on politicians. And he's gonna. Yes, Texas Betsy, I know barley is not a grass, but that's how it's sold. Barley grass juice. It. Climate change is affecting places like Bangladesh right now. Climate change is affecting the Maldives right now. Now, how long, let's just check the record, and I don't have it in front of me, How long have we known about the Maldive Islands? How long have the Maldive Islands been inhabited by humans? Have the Maldives been inhabited by humans longer than the onset of the Little Ice Age? I mean, and this is just fun with reasoning, right? But the Maldive Islands are going underwater right now. And it's not because they're sinking, it's because the water is rising. The global south is already in the midst of climate crisis. But see, John Mackey is just up to his wealthy little neck in privilege. And so, while he can say, I hate to see billions of people condemned to remain in poverty because of climate change fears, while he can say that, they are, for all intents and purposes, functionally invisible to him. At least until they've got enough money to shop in his stores. And yeah, he's going to spend his money advancing his idiocy. And there are elected representatives who are going to be more than happy to take the money. God almighty. Like I said, morons, we've got them. Mark, who is in the chat room as Mark in SF, just dropped a note along after I said thank you for the kind contribution a little bit ago. Mark says, I'm very happy to have finally been in a position to make my first financial contribution to the Horn. For your information, the quirky amount of the donation is a multiple of 18, a Jewish tradition of wishing long life, chai, as in l'chaim, sums up numerologically in Hebrew to 18 by giving multiples of 18. I'm also sending multiple wishes of long life to the Horn and all the members of its family. Mark says, I've been a listener to the Horn on TuneIn for about a year now, during which time I've been forlorn that I simply couldn't do anything financially to help out. As a teaching graduate student in computer science, you may surmise my financial situation has been somewhat limited. I recently got a job as a researcher and so have been making the rounds of donations. With each paycheck, I give to one of the not-for-profit media sources that have sustained me, keeping me company in the background as I've been chained to my keyboard. Even though Stephanie helps me wake up with a chuckle, by far the Horn family has been my go-to feel-good spot on the internet dial. There aren't many places in this world where my love of history, Star Trek, religion, politics, food porn, and the English language can be satisfied in quite as charming, accessible, and literate ways as they are listening to the excellent Horn Network. I'm infinitely pleased to finally be able to help out in a more substantial way than just raving to my friends about you, though by now my friends are used to my liberal raving. Oh, rave on, Mark. I understand that you're coming to San Francisco in the next week or so. I am. Though I'm insanely busy, school is starting, and I'm still trying to get my new syllabi worked out for classes I teach. This semester I've abandoned the for-profit textbook thieves in favor of all online, open-source, free resources for my students. That's brilliant. I was inspired in no small part to do this because of the work that you do every weeknight on the air, putting it out there on faith of remuneration or at least operating expenses. If during your time here you need emergency tech support, I'm at your limited disposal. Thank you, Mark. I won't be doing any broadcasting. I'm going to be flying out on a Friday. We've got things on Saturday and perhaps Sunday and then flying out on Monday morning. So hopefully there will not be any tech crises, but I thank you very kindly for the generous offer, especially given your schedule. Mark says, I look forward to someday working up the courage to call. Even though I get up and talk in front of crowds of people every day and have had experience co-hosting a nationally syndicated radio call-in show, formerly the Wizard of Soz, on a computer call-in tech show, I am still a shrinking pansy. I reference that flower advisedly. Warmest regards and a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year to you and yours. Thank you. Thank you so very much, Mark. It is appreciated. That's just wonderful. Because I love getting notes like that, because something makes me think that, you know, Limbaugh probably doesn't get that kind of a note. First of all, you can't send things written on crayon through the email without more technical expertise than your general crayon-using, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, right-wing freak can muster. Probably have to go to a liberal friend to get it scanned, and, well, it all goes downhill from there. With regard to climate change, Kevin in Colorado Springs says, how many times does it have to snow in L.A. and Florida before they admit it? And I don't know if there's a straight up answer to that. I really don't. I don't. It's kind of like some of the stuff we deal with here with mountaintop removal. You would think after a sludge dam collapsed in 1972 that there would be no more sludge dams, but instead. Instead, that thing was a multi-million gallon sludge dam. Now we have sludge dams that are approaching 10 billion gallons, if one can even conceive of that. It didn't slow them down. It inspired them to do worse. So, you know, how many times did... I don't know. But by the same token, I think there's real value in what Bill McKibben is suggesting, trying to get people on President's Day to Washington, D.C. to make a big noise to actually get stuff done. It makes sense to me. It's about 15 minutes before the hour. Time for a couple of more nominations, if that's okay. Let's go to Alabama Stan for this one. Then we'll kind of work our way west. Now, they've just about managed to wipe out access to women's reproductive health services in Mississippi, Stan, but they haven't completely succeeded in Alabama, Stan. They do have reproductive health clinics there. And they torment people. I said we would work our way west. On my Facebook page, our good friend Beth posted something the other day, or maybe earlier today, that I read and was just sickened and horrified. She posted I gotta find it here. Pardon me. It was how I spent my MLK Day holiday. Oh, there it is. How I spent Gun Appreciation Day surrounded. And Beth linked to an article. You can find this over on my Facebook page. Crowd of 8,000 to 10,000 protest abortion Saturday in downtown Dallas. An estimated 8,000 to 10,000 anti-abortion demonstrators marched from the Cathedral Shrine of the Virgin of Guadalupe on Ross Avenue to the Earl Cabell Federal Building on Griffin Street, where the Roe v. Wade abortion lawsuit was filed in 1970. "We wanted to pray at the court building where the lawsuit began," said Sister Bernadette Nguyen, who drove from Houston with a group of Vietnamese Dominican sisters. They recited the rosary as the march wound through largely vacant downtown streets. Protests drew a wide range of ethnic groups, many of whom carried homemade or manufactured signs and targeted abortion. "Don't mess with unborn Texans," warned one sign. "Save the babies," said another. Bishop Kevin Farrell, one of a dozen rally speakers who has no understanding whatsoever of what went on in places like Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz, said, speaking of abortion, "This Holocaust has to come to an end." That's Dallas. It's a little different over in Alabama, Stan. In a story detailed at AL.com, Huntsville's abortion rights activist, there's a Huntsville in Alabama and a Huntsville in Texas, this is the one in Alabama. Huntsville's abortion rights activists, pro and con, claim moral religious high ground. Well, that certainly clears things up for me from a headline reading perspective. This piece by a woman named Kay Campbell begins, "One thing for sure, Jesus walks the sidewalk of the Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives in Huntsville, especially on days when abortions could be happening inside." What, Edith? And let's see, one woman was sprayed in the face with what was allegedly holy water, and the woman who sprayed her said she was merely spraying to clear the air because, you know, those heathens were burning sage. It's called a smudge. It's a purification ritual. They held their Stand for Life today on the east steps of the Madison County, Alabama courthouse. The keynote speaker was Alabama First Lady Diane Bentley. Being as it's in Alabama, it took on a religious tone. One person wearing a gray and black striped suit with a yellow Star of David appliqued over the left breast held up a sign saying, "Hitler's Choice." The woman who sprayed somebody down with so-called holy water was Joyce Fecto, a 70-year-old woman. That happened back around Christmas. She said, "I was spritzing holy water to cleanse the air of smoke from a pro-choicer's sage smudge." And she just walked into the spray. Well, thank God it was just holy water. She might have otherwise walked into a bullet, right? But then there's the real coup de grace, if you will. Because it needs to be borne in mind that not everything takes place in a women's reproductive health care clinic is abortion per se. We need to also bear in mind that even if it is, it's legal, it's decided, the issue is over with, and these freaks need to go the hell home. But there are all kinds of tough decisions that are made. One woman This happened last month. Imagine, if you can, going to the doctor and getting this news. The woman had been pregnant, and her doctor had the unenviable task of explaining to her that her baby had died in her womb. She had to go because it is the nature of being human that a woman cannot carry a dead fetus and expect to live herself. And so she went to the clinic in Huntsville, where she was met by a bunch of right-wing weirdos who, as she walked into the clinic, serenaded her by singing, "Happy Birthday, Dead Baby." That is how vicious and cruel and uncaring these followers of the Prince of Peace are. Try to live with that for 10 seconds inside your own skull and see where it takes you. The horror of knowing that a child you had looked forward to raising, of marking milestones for, and it can't reach birth, it can't have life. And so, as you reach that place where you must deal with something you never even imagined in your wildest nightmares, there are a bunch of theocratic thugs on the sidewalk singing to you, months pregnant, showing, obviously pregnant, "Happy Birthday, Dead Baby." The news story says that the father of the baby, who was escorting the mother, had to be physically restrained. Of the mother making that horrible, horrible decision, that horribly unavoidable decision that a bunch of right-wing theocratic thugs can't tolerate, well, she was, in the words of the story, an emotional wreck. There is work to be done, rights to be protected, and rights to be advanced. Coffee breaks over. Back on your heads. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thank you. Thank you, Mark, for the kind contribution. Thank you, Brian, for the kind contribution that got us very near to our evening's fundraising goal. It is what makes this continue to happen night after night. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Sparky's also the moderator of the weekend Horn Malloy Skype group, which is a big, big lot of fun. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes for the help with the posts. Thanks to John Fox, busily working away down in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, It's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.